so that I have been able to finish my work here. And was it not discovered that your sheets were unhemmed? Oh, no. For when I had taken out the thread I required, I hemmed the edges over again. With what? With this needle, said the abbe, as, opening his ragged vestments, he showed Dantès a long, sharp fishbone with a small perforated eye for the thread, a small portion of which still remained in it. I once thought, continued Faria, of removing these iron bars and letting myself down from the window, which, as you see, is somewhat wider than yours, although I should have enlarged it still more preparatory to my flight. However, I discovered that I should merely have dropped into a sort of inner court, and I therefore renounced the project altogether as too full of risk and danger. Nevertheless, I carefully preserved my ladder against one of those unforeseen opportunities of which I spoke just now, and which sudden chance frequently brings about. While affecting to be deeply engaged in examining the ladder, the mind of Dantès was, in fact, busily occupied by the idea that a person so intelligent, ingenious, and clear-sighted as the abbé might probably be enabled to dive into the dark recesses of his own misfortunes and cause that light to shine upon the mystery connected with them he had in vain sought to elicit. "What are you thinking of?" asked the abbé, smilingly, imputing the deep abstraction in which his visitor was plunged to the excess of his awe and wonder. "I was reflecting in the first place," replied Dantès, "upon the enormous degree of intelligence and ability you must have employed to reach the high perfection to which you have attained. If you thus surpass all mankind while but a prisoner, what would you not have accomplished free?" "Possibly nothing at all. The overflow of my brain would probably, in a state of freedom, have evaporated in a thousand follies. It needs trouble and difficulty and danger to hollow out various mysterious and hidden mines of human intelligence. Pressure is required, you know, to ignite powder. Captivity has collected into one single focus all the floating faculties of my mind. They have come into close contact in the narrow space in which they have been wedged, and you are well aware that from the collision of clouds electricity is produced. From electricity comes the lightning, from whose flash we have light amid our greatest darkness." "Alas, no," replied Dantès. "I know not that these things follow in such natural order. Oh, I am very ignorant, and you must be blessed indeed to possess the knowledge you have." The abbé smiled. "Well," said he, "but you had another subject for your thoughts besides admiration for me. Did you not say so just now?" "I did. You have told me as yet but one of them. Let me hear the other. It was this, that while you had related to me all the particulars of your past life, you were perfectly unacquainted with mine. Your life, my young friend, has not been of sufficient length to admit of your having passed through any very important events. It has been long enough to inflict on me a misfortune so great, so crushingly overwhelming, that, unconscious as I am of having in any way deserved it, I would fain know who of all mankind has been the accursed author of it, that I may no longer accuse heaven, as I have done in my fury and despair, of willful injustice towards an innocent and injured man. Then you profess ignorance of the crime with which you are charged? I do indeed, and this I swear by the two beings most dear to me upon earth, my father and Mercedes. Come, said the abbé, closing his hiding-place and pushing the bed back to its original situation, let me hear your story. Dantès obeyed, and commenced what he called his history, but which consisted only of the account of a voyage to India and two or three in the Levant, until he arrived at the recital of his last cruise, with the death of Captain Leclerc and the receipt of a packet to be delivered by himself to the Grand Maréchal, his interview with that personage, and his receiving in place of the packet brought a letter addressed to Monsieur Noirtier, his arrival at Marseille and interview with his father, his affection for Mercedes and their nuptial fête, his arrest and subsequent examination in the temporary prison of the Palais de Justice, ending in his final imprisonment in the Château d'If. From the period of his arrival, all was a blank to Dantès. He knew nothing, not even the length of time he had been imprisoned. His recital finished, the abbé reflected long and earnestly. "There is," said he, at the end of his meditations, "a clever maxim which bears upon what I was saying to you some little while ago, and that is, that unless wicked ideas take root in a naturally depraved mind, human nature, in a right and wholesome state, revolts at crime. Still, from an artificial civilization have originated wants, vices, and false tastes, which occasionally become so powerful as to stifle within us all good feelings, and ultimately to lead us into guilt and wickedness. From this view of things, then, comes the axiom I allude to, that if you wish to discover the author of any bad action, seek first to discover the person to whom the perpetration of that bad action could be in any way advantageous. Now, to apply it in your case, to whom could your disappearance have been serviceable? To no breathing soul. Why, who could have cared about the removal of so insignificant a person as myself? Do not speak thus, for your reply evinces neither logic nor philosophy. Everything is relative, my dear young friend, from the king who obstructs his successor's immediate possession of the throne, to the occupant of a place for which the supernumerary to whom it has been promised ardently longs. Now, in the event of the king's death, his successor inherits a crown. When the placeman dies, the supernumerary steps into his shoes and receives his salary of 12,000 livres. Well, these 12,000 livres are his civil list, and are as essential to him as the 12 millions of a king. Every individual, from the highest to the lowest degree, has his place in the ladder of social life, and around him are grouped a little world of interests, composed of stormy passions and conflicting atoms. But let us return to your world. You say you were on the point of being appointed captain of the Pharaon?
I was.
And about to become the husband of a young and lovely girl?
True.
Now, could anyone have had an interest in preventing the accomplishment of these two circumstances? But let us first settle the question as to its being the interest of anyone to hinder you from being captain of the Pharaon. What say you?
I cannot believe such was the case. I was generally liked on board, and had the sailors possessed the right of selecting a captain themselves, I feel convinced their choice would have fallen on me. There was only one person among the crew who had any feeling of ill will towards me. I had quarrelled with him some time previously, and had even challenged him to fight me, but he refused.
Now we are getting on. And what was this man's name?
Danglars.
What rank did he hold on board?
He was supercargo.
And had you been captain, should you have retained him in his employment?
Not if the choice had remained with me, for I had frequently observed inaccuracies in his accounts.
Good again. Now then, tell me, was any person present during your last conversation with Captain Leclerc?
No, we were quite alone.
Could your conversation be overheard by anyone?
It might, for the cabin door was open, and stay, now I recollect. Danglars himself passed by just as Captain Leclerc was giving me the packet for the Grand Marechal.
That will do, cried the abbé. Now we are on the right scent. Did you take anybody with you when you put into the port of Elbe?
Nobody.
Somebody there received your packet and gave you a letter in place of it, I think.
Yes, the Grand Marechal did.
And what did you do with that letter?
Put it into my pocketbook.
Ah, indeed. You had your pocketbook with you then. Now, how could a pocketbook, large enough to contain an official letter, find sufficient room in the pockets of a sailor?
You are right. I had it not with me. It was left on board.
Then it was not till your return to the ship that you placed the letter in the pocketbook.
No. And what did you do with this same letter while returning from Porto Ferrajo to your vessel?
I carried it in my hand, so that when you went on board the Pharaon, everybody could perceive you held a letter in your hand.
To be sure they could.
Danglars, as well as the rest?
Yes, he as well as others.
Now listen to me, and try to recall every circumstance attending your arrest. Do you recollect the words in which the information against you was couched?
Oh, yes, I read it over 3 times, and the words sunk deeply into my memory.
Repeat it to me.
Dantès paused a few instants as though collecting his ideas, then said,
This is it, word for word.
Monsieur le procureur du roi is informed by a friend to the throne and religion that an individual named Edmond Dantès, second in command on board the Pharaon, this day arrived from Smyrna after having touched at Naples and Porto Ferrajo, has been charged by Murat with a packet for the usurper, again by the usurper with a letter for the Bonapartist club in Paris. This proof of his guilt may be procured by his immediate arrest, as the letter will be found either about his person, at his father's residence, or in his cabin on board the Pharaon.
The abbé shrugged up his shoulders.
The thing is clear as day, said he, and you must have had a very unsuspecting nature, as well as a good heart, not to have suspected the origin of the whole affair.
Do you really think so?
Ah, that would indeed be the treachery of a villain.
How did Danglars usually write?
Oh, extremely well.
And how was the anonymous letter written?
All the wrong way. Backwards, you know.
Again the abbé smiled.
In fact, it was a disguised hand.
I don't know. It was very boldly written, if disguised.
Stop a bit, said the abbé, taking up what he called his pen, and, after dipping it into the ink, he wrote on a morsel of prepared linen with his left hand the first 2 or 3 words of the accusation.
Dantès drew back and gazed on the abbé with a sensation almost amounting to terror.
"How very astonishing!" cried he at length. "Why, your writing exactly resembles that of the accusation, simply because that accusation had been written with the left hand. And I have always remarked one thing.
What is that?
That whereas all writing done with the right hand varies, that performed with the left hand is invariably similar.
You have evidently seen and observed everything.
Let us proceed.
Oh, yes, yes, let us go on.
Now, as regards the second question, was there any person whose interest it was to prevent your marriage with Mercedes?
Yes, a young man who loved her.
And his name was Fernand.
That is a Spanish name, I think.
He was a Catalan.
You imagine him capable of writing the letter?
Oh, no. He would more likely have got rid of me by sticking a knife into me.
That is in strict accordance with the Spanish character.
An assassination they will unhesitatingly commit, but an act of cowardice never.
Besides, said Dantès, the various circumstances mentioned in the letter were wholly unknown to him.
You had never spoken of them yourself to anyone?
To no person whatever.
Not even to your mistress?
No.
Not even to my betrothed bride.
Then it is Danglars, beyond a doubt.
I feel quite sure of it now.
Wait a little.
Pray, was Danglars acquainted with Fernand?
No.
Yes, he was.
Now I recollect.
What?
To have seen them both sitting at table together beneath an arbor at Père Pomfile the evening before the day fixed for my wedding. They were in earnest conversation. Danglars was joking in a friendly way, but Fernand looked pale and agitated.
Were they alone?
There was a third person with them, whom I knew perfectly well, and who had, in all probability, made their acquaintance. He was a tailor named Caderousse. But he was quite intoxicated.
Stay,
how strange that it should not have occurred to me before. Now I remember quite well that on the table round which they were sitting were pens, ink, and paper.
Oh, the heartless, treacherous scoundrels! Exclaimed Dantès, pressing his hand to his throbbing brows.
Is there anything else I can assist you in discovering besides the villainy of your friends? Inquired the abbe.
Yes. Yes, replied Dantès eagerly. I would beg of you, who see so completely to the depths of things, and to whom the greatest mystery seems but an easy riddle, to explain to me how it was that I underwent no second examination, was never brought to trial, and, above all, my being condemned without ever having had sentence passed on me.
That is altogether a different and more serious matter, responded the abbe. The ways of justice are frequently too dark and mysterious to be easily penetrated. All we have hitherto done in the matter has been child's play. If you wish me to enter upon the more difficult part of the business, you must assist me by the most minute information on every point.
That I will, gladly. So pray begin, my dear abbe, and ask me whatever questions you please, for in good truth you seem to turn over the pages of my past life far better than I could do myself.
In the first place, then, who examined you? The procureur de roi, his deputy, or a magistrate?
A deputy.
Was he young or old?
About 26 or 27 years of age, I should say.
To be sure, answered the abbe. Old enough to be ambitious, but not sufficiently so to have hardened his heart.
And how did he treat you?
With more of mildness than severity.
Did you tell him your whole story?
I did. And did his conduct change at all in the course of your examination?
Yes.
Certainly he did appear much disturbed when he read the letter that had brought me into this scrape. He seemed quite overcome at the thoughts of the danger I was in.
You were in?
Yes.
For whom else could he have felt any apprehensions?
Then you feel quite convinced he sincerely pitied your misfortune?
Why, he gave me one great proof of his sympathy at least.
And what was that?
He burnt the sole proof that could at all have criminated me.
Do you mean the letter of accusation?
Oh, no, the letter I was entrusted to convey to Paris.
Are you sure he burnt it?
He did so, before my eyes.
Aye, indeed. That alters the case and leads to the conclusion that this man might, after all, be a greater scoundrel than I at first believed.
Upon my word, said Dantès, you make me shudder. If I listen much longer to you, I shall believe the world is filled with tigers and crocodiles.
Only remember that two-legged tigers and crocodiles are more dangerous than those that walk on four.
Never mind, let us go on,
with all my heart.
You tell me he burnt the letter in your presence?
He did, saying at the same time, you see, I thus destroy the only proof existing against you.
This action is somewhat too sublime to be natural.
You think so?
I am sure of it.
To whom was this letter addressed?
To Monsieur Noirtier, number 13 Rue Coq Héron, Paris.
Now, can you conceive any interest your heroic deputy procureur could, by possibility, have had in the destruction of that letter?
Why, it is not altogether impossible he might have had,
for he made me promise several times never to speak of that letter to anyone, assuring me he so advised me for my own interest. And more than this, he insisted on my taking a solemn oath never to utter the name mentioned in the address.
Noirtier, repeated the abbe. Noirtier.
I knew a person of that name at the court of the Queen of Etruria, a Noirtier who had been a Girondin during the Revolution. What was your deputy called?
De Villefort.
The abbe burst into a fit of laughter, while Dantès gazed on him in utter astonishment.
What ails you? Said he at length.
Do you see this ray of light?
I do.
Well, I see my way into the full meaning of all the proceedings against you more clearly than you even discern that sunbeam.
Poor fellow. Poor young man.
And you tell me this magistrate expressed great sympathy and commiseration for you?
He did.
And the worthy man destroyed your compromising letter?
He burnt it before me, and then made you swear never to utter the name of Noirtier?
Certainly.
Why, you poor, short-sighted simpleton,
Can you not guess who this Noirtier was, whose very name he was so careful to keep concealed?
Indeed, I cannot. No other than the father of your sympathetic deputy procureur.
Had a thunderbolt fallen at the feet of Dantès, or hell opened its yawning gulf before him, he could not have been more completely transfixed with horror than at the sound of words so wholly unexpected, revealing as they did the fiendish perfidy which had consigned him to wear out his days in the dark cell of a prison that was to him as a living grave. Starting up, he clasped his hands around his head as though to prevent his very brain from bursting, as in a choked and almost inarticulate voice he exclaimed, "His father! Oh, no! Not his father, surely!"
"His own father, I assure you," replied the abbé. "His right name was Noirtier de Villefort."
At this instant a bright light shot through the mind of Dantès and cleared up all that had been dark and obscure before. The change that had come over Villefort during the examination, the destruction of the letter, the exacted promise, the almost supplicating tones of the magistrate, who seemed rather to implore mercy than denounce punishment, all returned with a stunning force to his memory. A cry of mental agony escaped his lips, and he staggered against the wall almost like a drunken man. Then, as the paroxysm passed away, he hurried to the opening conducting from the abbé's cell to his own and said, "I must be alone to think over all this." When he regained his dungeon, he threw himself on his bed, where the turnkey found him at his evening visit, sitting with fixed gaze and contracted features, still and motionless as a statue. But during hours of deep meditation, which to him had seemed but as minutes, he had formed a fearful resolution and bound himself to its fulfillment by a solemn oath. Dantès was at length roused from his reverie by the voice of Faria, who, having also been visited by his jailer, had come to invite his fellow sufferer to share his supper. The reputation of being out of his mind, though harmlessly and even amusingly so, had procured for the abbé greater privileges than were allowed to prisoners in general. He was supplied with bread of a finer, whiter description than the usual prison fare, and even regaled each Sunday with a small quantity of wine. The present day chanced to be Sunday, and the abbé came delighted at having such luxuries to offer his new friend. Dantès followed him with a firm and assured step. His features had lost their almost spasmodic contraction, and now wore their usual expression, but there was that in his whole appearance that bespoke one who had come to a fixed and desperate resolve. Faria bent on him his penetrating eye. "I regret now," said he, "having helped you in your late inquiries, or having given you the information I did."
"Why so?" inquired Dantès.
"Because it has instilled a new passion in your heart, that of vengeance." A bitter smile played over the features of the young man. "Let us talk of something else," said he. Again the abbé looked at him, then mournfully shook his head, but in accordance with Dantès' request, he began to speak of other matters. The elder prisoner was one of those persons whose conversation, like that of all who have experienced many trials, contained many useful and important hints, as well as sound information. But it was never egotistical, for the unfortunate man never alluded to his own sorrows. Dantès listened with admiring attention to all he said. Some of his remarks corresponded with what he already knew, or applied to the sort of knowledge his nautical life had enabled him to acquire. A part of the good abbé's words, however, were wholly incomprehensible to him. But, like those aurorae which serve to light the navigators in southern latitudes, they sufficed to open fresh views to the inquiring mind of the listener, and to give a glimpse of new horizons, illumined by the wild meteoric flash, enabling him justly to estimate the delight an intellectual mind would have in following the high and towering spirit of one so richly gifted as Faria in all the giddiest heights or lowest depths of science. "You must teach me a small part of what you know," said Dantès, "if only to prevent your growing weary of me. I can well believe that so learned a person as yourself would prefer absolute solitude to being tormented with the company of one as ignorant and uninformed as myself.
If you will only agree to my request, I promise you never to mention another word about escaping." The abbe smiled. "Alas, my child," said he, "human knowledge is confined within very narrow limits, and when I have taught you mathematics, physics, history, and the 3 or 4 modern languages with which I am acquainted, you will know as much as I do myself. Now, it will scarcely require 2 years for me to communicate to you the stock of learning I possess."
2 years, exclaimed Dantès. "Do you really believe I can acquire all these things in so short a time? Not their application, certainly, but their principles, you may. To learn is not to know. There are the learners and the learned. Memory makes the one, philosophy the other."
"But can I not learn philosophy as well as other things, my boy? Philosophy, as I understand it, is reducible to no rules by which it can be learned. It is the amalgamation of all the sciences, the golden cloud which bears the soul to heaven."
"Well then," said Dantès, "leaving philosophy out of the question, tell me what you shall teach me first. I feel my great need of scientific knowledge and long to begin the work of improvement. Say, when shall we commence?"
"Directly, if you will," said the abbe.
And that very evening the prisoners sketched a plan of education to be entered upon the following day. Dantès possessed a prodigious memory, combined with an astonishing quickness and readiness of conception. The mathematical turn of his mind rendered him apt at all kinds of calculation, while his naturally poetical feelings threw a light and pleasing veil over the dry reality of arithmetical computation or the rigid severity of lines. He already knew Italian, and had also picked up a little of the Romaic dialect during his different voyages to the East, and by the aid of these two languages he easily comprehended the construction of all the others, so that at the end of 6 months he began to speak Spanish, English, and German. In strict accordance with the promise made to the abbe, Dantès never even alluded to flight. It might have been that the delight his studies afforded him supplied the place of liberty, or, probably, the recollection of his pledged word, a point, as we have already seen, to which he paid a rigid attention, kept him from reverting to any plan for escape. But absorbed in the acquisition of knowledge, days, even months, passed by unheeded in one rapid and instructive course. Time flew on, and at the end of a year Dantès was a new man. With Faria, on the contrary, Dantès remarked that, spite of the relief his society afforded, he daily grew sadder. One thought seemed incessantly to harass and distract his mind. Sometimes he would fall into long reveries, sigh heavily and involuntarily, then suddenly rise and, with folded arms, begin pacing the confined space of his dungeon. One day he stopped all at once in the midst of these so often repeated promenades and exclaimed, "Ah, if there were no sentinel!"
"There shall not be one a minute longer than you please," said Dantès, who had followed the working of his thoughts as accurately as though his brain were enclosed in crystal, so clear as to display its minutest operations.
"I have already told you," answered the abbe, "that I loathe the idea of shedding blood. Still, in our case the death we should bestow would not be dictated by any wild or savage propensity, but as a necessary step to secure our own personal safety and preservation. No matter. I could never agree to it."
"Still, you have thought of it incessantly, alas," cried the abbe, "and you have discovered a means of regaining our freedom, have you not?" asked Dantès eagerly.
"I have. If it were only possible to place a deaf and blind sentinel in the gallery beyond us,
I will undertake to make him both," replied the young man, with an air of determined resolution that made his companion shudder.
"No, no," cried the abbe. "I tell you the thing is impossible. Name it no more." In vain did Dantès endeavour to renew the subject. The abbe shook his head in token of disapproval, but refused any further conversation respecting it. 3 months passed away.
"Do you feel yourself strong?" inquired the abbe of Dantès. The young man, in reply, took up the chisel, bent it into the form of a horseshoe, and then, as readily, straightened it.
"And will you engage not to do any harm to the sentry, except as a last extremity? I promise on my honour not to hurt a hair of his head, unless positively obliged for our mutual preservation."
"Then," said the abbe, "we may hope to put our design into execution. And how long shall we be in accomplishing the necessary work?"
"At least a year. And shall we begin at once?"
"Directly. We have lost a year to no purpose," cried Dantès.
"Do you consider the last 12 months as wasted?" asked the abbe in a tone of mild reproach.
"Forgive me," cried Edmond, blushing deeply. "I am indeed ungrateful to have hinted such a thing."
"Tut, tut," answered the abbe. "Man is but man at last, and you are about the best specimen of the genus I have ever known. Come, let me show you my plan."
The abbe then showed Dantès the sketch he had made for their escape. It consisted of a plan of his own cell and that of Dantès, with the corridor which united them. In this passage he proposed to form a tunnel, such as is employed in mines. This tunnel would conduct the two prisoners immediately beneath the gallery where the sentry kept watch. Once there, a large excavation would be made, and one of the flagstones with which the gallery was paved be so completely loosened that at the desired moment it would give way beneath the soldiers' feet, who, falling into the excavation below, would be immediately bound and gagged ere, stunned by the effects of his fall, he had power to offer resistance. The prisoners were then to make their way through one of the gallery windows and to let themselves down from the outer walls by means of the abbe's ladder of cords. The eyes of Dantès sparkled with joy, and he rubbed his hands with delight at the idea of a plan so simple, yet apparently so certain to succeed. That very day the miners commenced their labours, and that with so much more vigour and alacrity as it succeeded to a long rest from fatigue, and was destined, in all probability, to carry out the dearest wish of the heart of each. Nothing interrupted the progress of their work except the necessity of returning to their respective cells against the hour in which their jailer was in the habit of visiting them. They had learned to distinguish the most imperceptible sound of his footsteps as he descended towards their dungeons, and happily never failed being prepared for his coming. The fresh earth excavated during their present work, and which would have entirely blocked up the old passage, was thrown by degrees and with the utmost precaution out of the window in either Faria's or Dante's cell, the rubbish being first pulverized so finely that the night wind carried it far away without permitting the smallest trace to remain. More than a year had been consumed in this undertaking, the only tools for which had been a chisel, a knife, and a wooden lever. Faria, still continuing to instruct Dantès by conversing with him, sometimes in one language, sometimes in another, at others relating to him the history of nations and great men who, from time to time, have left behind them one of those bright tracks called glory. The abbe was a man of the world, and had, moreover, mixed in the first society of the day. His appearance was impressed with that air of melancholy dignity which Dantès, thanks to the imitative powers bestowed on him by nature, easily acquired, as well as that outward polish and politeness he had before been wanting in, and which is seldom possessed except by those who have been placed in constant intercourse with persons of high birth and breeding. At the end of 15 months, the tunnel was made, and the excavation completed beneath the gallery, and the two workmen could distinctly hear the measured tread of the sentinel as he paced to and fro over their heads. Compelled, as they were, to await a night sufficiently dark to favour their flight, they were obliged to defer their final attempt till that auspicious moment should arrive. Their greatest dread now was lest the stone through which the sentry was doomed to fall should give way before its right time, and this they had in some measure provided against by placing under it as a kind of prop, a sort of bearer they had discovered among the foundations through which they had worked their way. Dantès was occupied in arranging this piece of wood when he heard Faria, who had remained in Edmund's cell for the purpose of cutting a peg to secure their rope ladder, call to him in accents of pain and suffering. Dantès hastened to his dungeon, where he found him standing in the middle of the room, pale as death, his forehead streaming with perspiration, and his hands clenched tightly together. "Gracious heavens!" exclaimed Dantès. "What is the matter? What has happened? Quick, quick," returned the abbé. "Listen to what I have to say." Dantès looked in fear and wonder at the livid countenance of Faria, whose eyes, already dull and sunken, were circled by a halo of a bluish cast. His lips were white as those of a corpse, and his very hair seemed to stand on end. "For God's sake," cried Dantès, "what is the meaning of this? Tell me, I beseech you, what ails you?" "Alas," faltered out the abbé, "all is over with me. I am seized with a terrible, perhaps mortal, illness. I can feel that the paroxysm is fast approaching. I had a similar attack the year previous to my imprisonment. This malady admits but of one remedy. I will tell you what that is. Go into my cell as quickly as you can. Draw out one of the feet that support the bed. You will find it has been hollowed out for the purpose of containing a small phial. You will see there, half filled with a red-looking fluid. Bring it to me, or rather, no, I may be found here. Therefore, help me back to my room while I have any strength to drag myself along. Who knows what may happen, or how long the fit may last." In spite of the magnitude of the misfortune which thus suddenly frustrated his hopes, Dantès lost not his presence of mind, but descended into the corridor, dragging his unfortunate companion with him. Then, half carrying, half supporting him, he managed to reach the abbé's chamber, when he immediately laid the sufferer on his bed. "Thanks," said the poor abbé, shivering as though his veins were filled with ice. "Now that I am safely here, let me explain to you the nature of my attack and the appearance it will present. I am seized with a fit of catalepsy. When it comes to its height, I may probably lie still and motionless as though dead, uttering neither sigh nor groan. On the other hand, the symptoms may be much more violent and cause me to fall into fearful convulsions, cover my lips with foaming, and force from me the most piercing shrieks. This last evil you must carefully guard against, for were my cries to be heard, it is more than probable I should be removed to another part of the prison, and we be separated for ever. When I become quite motionless, cold, and rigid as a corpse, then, and not before, you understand, force open my teeth with a chisel, pour from 8 to 10 drops of the liquor contained in the phial down my throat, and I may perhaps revive." "Perhaps?" exclaimed Dantès, in grief-stricken tones. "Help! Help!" cried the abbé. I die! So sudden and violent was the fit that the unfortunate prisoner was unable to complete the sentence began. A violent convulsion shook his whole frame. His eyes started from their sockets. His mouth was drawn on one side. His cheeks became purple. He struggled, foamed, dashed himself about, and uttered the most dreadful cries, which, however, Dantès prevented from being heard by covering his head with the blanket. The fit lasted 2 hours. Then, more helpless than an infant, and colder and paler than marble, more crushed and broken than a reed trampled underfoot, he stretched himself out as though in the agonies of death, and became of the ghastly hue of the tomb. Edmund waited till life seemed extinct in the body of his friend. Then, taking up the chisel, he with difficulty forced open the closely fixed jaws, carefully poured the appointed number of drops down the rigid throat, and anxiously awaited the result. An hour passed away without the old man's giving the least sign of returning animation. Dantès began to fear he had delayed too long ere he administered the remedy, and thrusting his hands into his hair, continued gazing on the lifeless features of his friend in an agony of despair. At length, a slight colour tinged the livid cheeks. Consciousness returned to the dull, open eyeballs. A faint sigh issued from the lips, and the sufferer made a feeble effort to move. "He is saved! He is saved!" cried Dantès, in a paroxysm of delight. The sick man was not yet able to speak, but he pointed with evident anxiety towards the door. Dantès listened, and plainly distinguished the approaching steps of the jailer. It was therefore near 7 o'clock, but Edmund's anxiety had put all thoughts of time out of his head. The young man sprang to the entrance, darted through it, carefully drawing the stone over the opening, and hurried to his cell. He had scarcely done so before the door opened and disclosed to the jailer's inquisitorial gaze the prisoner seated as usual on the side of his bed. Almost before the key had turned in the lock, and before the departing steps of the jailer had died away in the long corridor he had to traverse, Dantès, whose restless anxiety concerning his friend left him no desire to touch the food brought him, hurried back to the abbé's chamber, and raising the stone by pressing his head against it, was soon beside the sick man's couch. Faria had now fully regained his consciousness, but he still lay helpless and exhausted on his miserable bed.
"I did not expect to see you again," said he feebly to Dantès.
"And why not?" asked the young man. "Did you fancy yourself dying?"
"No, I had no such idea. But knowing that all was ready for your flight, I considered you had availed yourself of it and were gone."
The deep glow of indignation suffused the cheeks of Dantès.
"And did you really think so meanly of me," cried he, "as to believe I would depart without you?"
"At least," said the abbé, "I now see how wrong such an opinion would have been.
Alas, alas, I am fearfully exhausted and debilitated by this attack."
"Be of good cheer," replied Dantès. "Your strength will return." And as he spoke, he seated himself on the bed beside Faria and tenderly chafed his chilled hands. The abbé shook his head.
"The former of these fits," said he, "lasted but half an hour, at the termination of which I experienced no other feeling than a great sensation of hunger, and I rose from my bed without requiring the least help. Now I can neither move my right arm nor leg, and my head seems uncomfortable, proving a rush of blood to the brain. The next of these fits will either carry me off or leave me paralyzed for life."
"No, no," cried Dantès. "You are mistaken. You will not die. And your third attack, if indeed you should have another, will find you at liberty. We shall save you another time as we have done this, only with a better chance because we shall be able to command every requisite assistance."
"My good Edmund," answered the abbé, "be not deceived. The attack which has just passed away condemns me for ever to the walls of a prison. None can fly from their dungeon but those who can walk."
"Well, well, perhaps just now you are not in a condition to effect your escape, but there is no hurry. We have waited so long we can very easily defer our purpose a little longer, say a week. A month, too, if necessary. By that time you will be quite well and strong, and as it only remains with us to fix the hour and minute, we will choose the first instant that you feel able to swim to execute our project."
"I shall never swim again," replied Faria. "This arm is paralyzed, not for a time, but for ever. Lift it and judge by its weight if I am mistaken."
The young man raised the arm, which fell back by its own weight, perfectly inanimate and helpless. A sigh escaped him.
"You are convinced now, Edmund, are you not?" asked the abbé. "Depend upon it, I know what I say. Since the first attack I experienced of this malady, I have continually reflected on it. Indeed, I expected it, for it is a family inheritance, both my father and grandfather having been taken off by it. The physician who prepared for me the remedy I have twice successfully taken was no other than the celebrated Cabanis. And he predicted a similar end for me. The physician may be mistaken," exclaimed Dantès. "And as for your poor arm, what difference will that make in our escape? Never mind if you cannot swim. I can take you on my shoulders and swim for both of us."
"My son," said the abbé, "you who are a sailor and a swimmer must know as well as I do that a man so loaded would sink ere he had advanced 50 yards in the sea. Cease, then, to allow yourself to be duped by vain hopes that even your own excellent heart refuses to believe in. Here I shall remain till the hour of my deliverance arrives, and that in all human probability will be the hour of my death.
As for you, who are young and active, delay not on my account, but fly. Go, I give you back your promise.
It is well, said Dantès. And now hear my determination also. Then rising and extending his hand with an air of solemnity over the old man's head, he slowly added, Here I swear to remain with you so long as life is spared to you, and that death only shall divide us.
Faria gazed fondly on his noble-minded but single-hearted young friend, and read in his honest, open countenance ample confirmation of truthfulness as well as sincere, affectionate, and faithful devotion.
"Thanks, my child," murmured the invalid, extending the one hand of which he still retained the use. "Thanks for your generous offer, which I accept as frankly as it was made."
Then, after a short pause, he added, "You may one of these days reap the reward of your disinterested devotion, but as I cannot and you will not quit this place, it becomes necessary to fill up the excavation beneath the soldier's gallery. He might, by chance, find out the hollow sound produced by his footsteps over the excavated ground and call the attention of his officer to the circumstance. That would bring about a discovery which would inevitably lead to our being separated. Go, then, and set about this work in which, unhappily, I can offer you no assistance. Keep at it all night if necessary, and do not return here tomorrow till after the jailer has visited me. I shall have something of the greatest importance to communicate to you."
Dantès took the hand of the abbé in his and affectionately pressed it. Faria smiled encouragingly on him, and the young man retired to his task, filled with a religious determination faithfully and unflinchingly to discharge the vow which bound him to his afflicted friend.
18. The Treasure. When Dantès returned next morning to the chamber of his companion in captivity, he found Faria seated and looking composed. In the ray of light which entered by the narrow window of his cell, he held open in his left hand, of which alone, it will be recollected, he retained the use, a morsel of paper which, from being constantly rolled into a small compass, had the form of a cylinder and was not easily kept open. He did not speak, but showed the paper to Dantès.
"What is that?" he inquired.
"Look at it," said the abbé with a smile. "I have looked at it with all possible attention," said Dantès, "and I only see a half-burnt paper on which are traces of Gothic characters traced with peculiar kind of ink."
"This paper, my friend," said Faria, "I may now avow to you, since I have proved you, this paper is my treasure, of which, from this day forth, one half belongs to you."
A cold damp started to Dantès' brow. Until this day, and what a space of time, he had avoided talking to the abbé of this treasure, the source whence accusation of madness against the poor abbé was derived. With his instinctive delicacy, Edmund had preferred avoiding any touch on this painful cord, and Faria had been equally silent. He had taken the silence of the old man for a return to reason, and now these few words uttered by Faria, after so painful a crisis, seemed to announce a serious relapse of mental alienation.
"Your treasure?" stammered Dantès. Faria smiled.
"Yes," said he. "You are indeed a noble heart, Edmund, and I see by your paleness and your shudder what is passing in your heart at this moment. No, be assured, I am not mad. This treasure exists, Dantès, and if I have not been allowed to possess it, you will. Yes, you. No one would listen to me or believe me because they thought me mad, but you, who must know that I am not, listen to me, and believe me afterwards if you will."
"Alas," murmured Edmund to himself, "this is a terrible relapse. There was only this blow wanting." Then he said aloud, "My dear friend, your attack has perhaps fatigued you. Had you not better repose a while? Tomorrow, if you will, I will hear your narrative, but today I wish to nurse you carefully. Besides, he said, a treasure is not a thing we need hurry. On the contrary, it must be hurried, Edmund, replied the old man. Who knows if tomorrow or the next day after the third attack may not come on, and then must not all be finished? Yes, indeed, I have often thought with a bitter joy that these riches, which would make the wealth of a dozen families, will be for ever lost to those men who persecute me. This idea was one of vengeance to me, and I tasted it slowly in the night of my dungeon and the despair of my captivity. But now I have forgiven the world for the love of you. Now I see you young and full of hope and prospect. Now that I think of all that may result to you in the good fortune of such a disclosure, I shudder at any delay and tremble lest I should not assure to one so worthy as yourself the possession of so vast an amount of hidden treasure. Edmund turned away his head with a sigh. You persist in your incredulity, Edmund, continued Faria. My words have not convinced you. I see you require proofs. Well, then, read this paper which I have never shown to anyone. Tomorrow, my dear friend, said Edmund, desirous of not yielding to the old man's madness, I thought it was understood that we should not talk of that until tomorrow. Then we will not talk of it until tomorrow. But read this paper today.
I will not irritate him, thought Edmund, and taking the paper, of which half was wanting, having been burnt, no doubt, by some accident, he read, This treasure, which may amount to 2 of Roman crowns in the most distant of the second opening w, declare to belong to him a la heir, 25th April, 1490.
Well, said Faria, when the young man had finished reading it.
Why, replied Dantès, I see nothing but broken lines and unconnected words which are rendered illegible by fire.
Yes, to you, my friend, who read them for the first time, but not for me, who have grown pale over them by many nights' study, and have reconstructed every phrase, completed every thought.
And do you believe you have discovered the concealed sense?
I am sure I have, and you shall judge for yourself. But first, listen to the history of this paper.
Silence! Exclaimed Dantès.
Steps approach. I go. Adieu.
And Dantès, happy to escape the history and explanation which could not fail to confirm to him his friend's malady, glided like a snake along the narrow passage, whilst Faria, restored by his alarm to a kind of activity, pushed with his foot the stone into its place and covered it with a mat in order the more effectually to avoid discovery. It was the governor, who, hearing of Faria's accident from the jailer, had come in person to see him. Faria sat up to receive him, and continued to conceal from the governor the paralysis that had already half-stricken him with death. His fear was lest the governor, touched with pity, might order him to be removed to a prison more wholesome, and thus separate him from his young companion. But fortunately this was not the case, and the governor left him convinced that the poor madman, for whom in his heart he felt a kind of affection, was only affected with a slight indisposition. During this time, Edmund, seated on his bed with his head in his hands, tried to collect his scattered thoughts. All was so rational, so grand, so logical with Faria, since he had known him, that he could not understand how so much wisdom on all points could be allied to madness in any one. Was Faria deceived as to his treasure, or was all the world deceived as to Faria?
Dantès remained in his cell all day, not daring to return to his friend, thinking thus to defer the moment when he should acquire the certainty that the abbé was mad. Such a conviction would be so terrible. but towards the evening, after the usual visitation, Faria, not seeing the young man appear, tried to move and get over the distance which separated them. Edmund shuddered when he heard the painful efforts which the old man made to drag himself along. His leg was inert, and he could no longer make use of one arm. Edmund was compelled to draw him towards himself, for otherwise he could not enter by the small aperture which led to Dante's chamber. "Here I am, pursuing you remorselessly," he said, with a benignant smile. "You thought to escape my munificence, but it is in vain. Listen to me." Edmund saw there was no escape, and placing the old man on his bed, he seated himself on the stool beside him. "You know," said the abbe, "that I was the secretary and intimate friend of the Cardinal Spada, the last of the princes of that name. I owe to this worthy lord all the happiness I ever knew. He was not rich, although the wealth of his family had passed into a proverb, and I heard the phrase very often, 'as rich as a Spada.' But he, like public rumor, lived on this reputation for wealth. His palace was my paradise. I instructed his nephews, who are dead, and when he was alone in the world, I returned to him by an absolute devotion to his will, all he had done for me during 10 years. The house of the cardinal had no secrets for me. I had often seen my noble patron annotating ancient volumes and eagerly searching amongst dusty family manuscripts. One day when I was reproaching him for his unavailing searches and the kind of prostration of mind that followed them, he looked at me and, smiling bitterly, opened a volume relating to the history of the city of Rome. There, in the 29th chapter of the life of Pope Alexander VI, were the following lines which I can never forget. 'The great wars of Romagna had ended. Cesar Borgia, who had completed his conquest, had need of money to purchase all Italy. The Pope had also need of money to conclude with Louis, the 12th King of France, formidable still in spite of his recent reverses, and it was necessary, therefore, to have recourse to some profitable speculation, which was a matter of great difficulty in the impoverished condition of exhausted Italy. His Holiness had an idea. He determined to make 2 cardinals. By choosing 2 of the greatest personages of Rome, especially rich men, this was the return the Holy Father looked for from his speculation. In the first place, he had to sell the great appointments and splendid offices which the cardinals already held, and then he had the 2 hats to sell besides. There was a third view in the speculation, which will appear hereafter. The Pope and Cesar Borgia first found the 2 future cardinals. They were Jean Rospigliosi, who held 4 of the highest dignities of the Holy Seat, and Cesar Spada, one of the noblest and richest of the Roman nobility. Both felt the high honor of such a favor from the Pope. They were ambitious, and these found, Cesar Borgia soon found purchasers for their appointments. The result was that Rospigliosi and Spada paid for being cardinals, and 8 other persons paid for the offices the cardinals held before their elevation, and thus 800,000 crowns entered into the coffers of the speculators. It is time now to proceed to the last part of the speculation. The Pope, having almost smothered Rospigliosi and Spada with caresses, having bestowed upon them the insignia of cardinal and induced them to realize their fortunes and fix themselves at Rome, the Pope and Cesar Borgia invited the 2 cardinals to dinner. This was a matter of dispute between the Holy Father and his son. Cesar thought they could make use of one of the means which he always had ready for his friends, that is to say, in the first place, the famous key with which they requested certain persons to go and open a particular cupboard. This key was furnished with a small iron point, a negligence on the part of the locksmith, when this was pressed to effect the opening of the cupboard, of which the lock was difficult, the person was pricked by this small point and died next day. Then there was the ring with the lion's head, which Caesar wore when he meant to give certain squeezes of the hand. The lion bit the hand thus favoured, and at the end of 24 hours the bite was mortal. Caesar then proposed to his father either to ask the cardinals to open the cupboard or give each a cordial squeeze of the hand, but Alexander VI replied to him, "Whilst we are thinking of those worthy cardinals, Spada and Rospigliosi, let us ask both of them to a dinner. Something tells me that we shall regain this money. Besides, you forget, Caesar, an indigestion declares itself immediately, whilst a prick or a bite occasions a day or two's delay." Caesar gave